Welcome to Legal Lens, a DebtWire podcast on legal issues impacting restructuring and the distressed industry at large. My name is Andy Serby. Today, I'm glad to be joined by Scott Maresco of Alvarez & Marsal. He's a managing director at the firm, advising clients on a range of topics related to taxes and restructuring situations, both in and out of bankruptcy. He also has specific experience in corporate M&A transactions. His engagements span several industries, ranging from utilities to healthcare services and well beyond. Scott, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Andy.
So, as we always like to get to know our guests a little bit right up top, I want to start off with kind of how'd you get into your line of work, getting into taxes and M&A?
Sure. So I was lucky enough, when I graduated college back in 1985, I was lucky enough to get a position with a firm, Deloitte Haskins & Sells, right into their tax department. Stay there for roughly 5 years, but what I was focusing on there was personal income tax work, and I knew I needed to have a change with that. So around 1991, I left DH&S, at least at the time, Deloitte & Touche, and went over to BDO Seidman, where I had a lot of opportunity to sort of hone my skills on corporate consolidated return issues. Had the opportunity to work with a bankruptcy group over at BDO with primarily specialized in creditor committee work. Had the opportunity there then to work with a partner at a KPMG who's since left the firm. But in doing that, she coaxed me over to KPMG, where I joined in 97. I made partner there in 98. I was in the New York office at the time. I got moved out to Chicago to start the Midwest M&A group for KPMG. And over my next 25 years, really specialized in corporate, cross-border, post-merger integration, IP planning, so on and so forth with respect to corporate M&A, but also a heavy influence on troubled company work, you know, working with debtors both in and out of court, you know, through their restructurings. It was great experience. I retired from KPMG last year, September of 2023. I joined Alvarez & Marsal in November of 23. Got over there through a common partner of mine who had left KPMG a number of years beforehand. And at A&M, you know, I definitely focus on the two aspects of what I did at KPMG: corporate M&A, primarily troubled company at this point in time, and then just outright debtor restructurings through in court or out of court.
Yeah, absolutely. I know that you've been at A&M for a year-ish, but I'd really like to know what it is about the firm that made you feel like you could expand your practice or really dig into the issues there before we dig into the issues here.
What I very much enjoyed about some of my time at KPMG was working with troubled companies, you know, across industries, you know, big companies, small companies, but really just working through the whole restructuring process. And at A&M, you know, they have like a flagship financial restructuring group, got a very talented, basically restructuring tax practice. And I really jumped on the opportunity to get involved with that because I wanted to continue my experience there. I wanted to continue working with troubled companies. It's very, for me, just fascinating. The various industries, the issues that they face, you know, working through the whole process, seeing them emerge and turn into profitable companies. And then also the opportunity to work with some younger people to help train them. You know, I've got a lot of experience. I've been in tax for, as I said, 39 years, almost 40 years. Very, very broad-based skill set that I have. And I like to be able to work with younger people just to be able to bring them up through their technical, you know, ranks.
Yeah, absolutely. Without any further ado, let's dig into that expertise. So first, I want to get into kind of tax consequences when we talk about debt transactions. We'll get into other transaction natures later. But we've talked a little bit in the past about distressed debt acquisition by related parties. Can you tell us a little bit about the kind of considerations that are necessary to advise your clients when we're talking about that sort of deal?
Sure. I think at least from a tax perspective, when you have a troubled company, it's issued debt past, you know, there's various reasons why the debt is trading at significant discounts. Then the company itself could be having a whole host of liquidity issues. And one of the ways in which they try to raise liquidity is to basically reduce their debt cost or reduce their debt balances. So if a company that's in that situation actually goes to reacquire its debt directly, either it's for cash or exchange it for stock or exchange it for debt, you know, that company in and of itself can recognize debt discharge income. It could be taxable, could result in taxable income, or you could exclude it if you're fortunate enough, or, well, maybe not, maybe unfortunate enough to either be in bankruptcy or be insolvent. People sort of lose, or companies sort of lose sight of the fact that you could be in this situation if you have a related party. And generally, the code defines related, basically how you test related party by looking at these 267 or these 707B1 rules. So to the extent you actually have a related party that buys in that debt, what happens to the debtor, it's basically the same as if it bought the debt back, except one big exception. So if the related party buys it in, the debtor actually is obligated to recognize debt discharge income. So let's say that the debtor had issued debt at 100. You know, for various reasons, it's trading at 70 cents on the dollar. Related party buys it in. Well, the debtor is obligated to pick up that 30% amount in taxable income if it's not either in bankruptcy or it's insolvent. And then what happens, because the debt is still outstanding, is the debtor actually is treated as reissuing a new debt obligation with an issue price of 70 and a stated redemption price of 100. So that 30 then becomes OID over the sort of the lifespan of that debt obligation. You know, it's subject to a couple of different tests. Number one is, is the debt instrument debt and not equity? Or to make sure that you don't run afoul of use of HIDTA rules, which would basically turn off the ability to have that deduction. The other thing that you have to be somewhat mindful of, and we're seeing in transactions today, is you have sort of a creditor, basically someone that holds the debt. Either they acquired the debt a number of years ago, the original holder of the debt, they become related to the debtor. Either it could be through, you know, contributing the debt to a new co that turns around and buys the debtor. So then you have these rules that then kick in and say, well, just because you were sort of non-related at the time, well, now you become related. And then when you become related, the same repercussions happen to the debtor. The debtor recognizes debt discharge income, and there's a deemed reissuance of these new debt obligations. But it really depends, the amount is somewhat dependent on how long that holder actually held the debt. So if a non-related party that becomes related had just bought the debt, let's say within a short time period in which it becomes related to the debtor, well, then it's basically the price that they paid for the debt. But if it's longer, it's been out there, you know, outstanding longer, it's held at a longer period of term, well, then it's the fair market value. So there's these tests that you have to run through. And we are seeing creditors today looking to still participate in the debtor business, and they're doing these debt exchanges, and they're walking into these 108 related party rules, so they have to be somewhat mindful of them.
Absolutely. Kind of on a different angle of this whole debt modification segment, can we talk a little bit about the key issues when we discuss like major modifications of publicly traded debt from your perspective?
This we see more often than not with the amount of portfolio companies or private equity groups or just, you know, subsidiaries within consolidated groups where they've issued debt, you know, over the last 5 years and the change in interest rates. There are significant discounts on these debt obligations. And they're, you know, these companies trying to increase their liquidity levels. They're basically looking at the debt saying, how can I change terms to actually increase my cash flows? So they're looking to change, you know, interest rates. They're looking to change payment terms. They're looking to change the nature of debt obligations. Each one of these could constitute a significant modification. And under the tax rules, if you have a significant modification of a debt instrument, there's a deemed exchange that occurs. And the deemed exchange, it results in a taxable transaction. So to the extent you have a debtor that has made major modifications to their debt instruments, and they've actually fallen to these rules, what's very important is how you determine the issue price of this new debt. And that really turns on if this debt is treated as publicly traded or not. Because if the new debt is treated as publicly traded, well, then it's the fair market value of that debt. If the debt is not treated as publicly traded and it has adequate stated interest, well, then it's just the issue price of the debt. So you're far better off. What companies don't necessarily focus on is, you know, you have to determine the issue price under these sort of OID rules, these 1273 rules. And it goes through sort of this hierarchy. Is the old debt publicly traded? Is the new debt publicly traded? You know, so on and so forth. And to the extent that So the new debt is publicly traded, well, it kind of governs. And then you have to go and determine, like, okay, what is the test? What is my test here? Is the new debt, does it have a sales price? Does it have a firm quote? Does it have an indicative quote? And this last one, this indicative quote, is what catches a lot of these issuances, because there's a lot of services out there that will give you a quote of the debt. Doesn't necessarily mean it's standing by the debt. It's just giving you a quote. And that's enough to cause it to be publicly traded. And a company, to the extent that they think that the price of the debt is too low, they can rebut it. But they can't rebut the presumption of it being publicly traded. They could just rebut the value of it. So it's very important on these significant modifications to pay close attention to this publicly traded part of it.
Now, Can we go into how much slash, I guess, whether these considerations change in a major way when a company is restructuring in versus out of Chapter 11 or Chapter 7? So in or out of court before we kind of get into different transaction styles next.
So to the extent that a company under the 108 rules, to the extent a company is realizing debt discharge income, but they're in bankruptcy, 108 kind of provides a general rule that, you know, basically the CODI is not taxable income, but the penalty they pay is they're obligated to reduce their tax attributes. So NOL carryforwards, capital loss carryforwards, some credits based on assets. What we are actually finding out today is companies that will go through these debt exchanges, they'll actually recognize debt discharge income, you know, they will fall under the insolvency exception. And generally, that's an immediately before test where you basically take the fair market value of your assets and compare it to your liabilities. So to the extent they're actually insolvent, you know, you could exclude it. But then if your post-change liabilities are greater than your tax basis, you know, tax basis is generally an attribute to reduce, but to the extent the tax basis is less than your liabilities, you have this thing called the 1017 liability floor. So you reduce the NOLs, the credits, the capital losses, but you won't reduce necessarily the tax basis in your assets, which is generally a good thing. It creates black hole COD. But if you're in a consolidated group that has an excess loss account, you have to be somewhat careful because some of that excess loss account can be triggered into taxable income.
Right. Now, like I mentioned, we're going to move into some other styles of transactions here. So let's get into the issues when we talk about the contribution of some distressed debts for CAV. Maybe let's start off with CAV.
I think I was talking about under 108(e)(4) rule where you have sort of distressed debt. Let's say you have a creditor. They originally lent money to a company for $100. That's their basis of the debt. It's trading at, you know, 70 cents on the dollar. And that creditor wants to continue to participate. What some companies are doing or some groups are doing is the creditors along with new investors will create a new co. What the creditor is contributing in is lost property because it's to him the basis is 100. And generally, you know, non-distressed situation, the basis of the property to the shareholder becomes the basis to the property of the corporation. But because it's an inherent loss, there's this rule, this 362(e)(2) rule that will say, if a shareholder is contributing in lost property in a 351 transaction, well, I have to reduce, the company has to reduce its basis in that asset to its fair market value. And the shareholder gets, basically, it's a carryover basis to the shares of stock it gets. And then to the extent that you have this sort of 108(e)(4), you know, related party relationship that occurs, there's a deemed satisfactory issue. So there's CODI that's recognized to the corporation, but there's no loss basically inherent in that, the receivable. So there's just general debt discharge income that gets recognized. So it's something that has to be, you know, you generally have to be mindful of. Now there's an election that the shareholder and the company can make, which basically would say, well, we'll keep the high basis in the loss asset as the basis to the corporation, but the repercussion to the shareholder is the shareholder actually has to reduce his basis in the stock that it gets. So if it turns around and sells the stock, obviously it would recognize a larger gain than if it just had the higher basis of the asset. So a bit of a trade-off there from the shareholder's perspective.
Sure. And what is this game if not just a series of trade-offs, right? The whole restructuring area. These next two things, let's get into first kind of return rules for intercompany debts. And then I think we're going to go straight into, you know, the issues that face these companies when we talk about buying up subsidiaries. We're just moving kind of beyond debt at this point.
Sure. In the consolidated group, when a company, you know, a parent and sub, an affiliated group of corporations decide to file a consolidated return, there is a provision in the consolidated return regs, it's 1502-13G, that governs sort of intercompany debt. And you have these situations where you have intercompany debt between a parent and a sub or two subs, and that debt through certain transactions, they call them triggering transactions. And generally, a triggering transaction is when the debt is satisfied. You know, the debtor and creditor, they take the corresponding positions and they sort of offset each other either through various transactions or they go away. And in some instances, you know, they don't result in what they call a satisfaction reissuance. And what happens in that transaction is that the debtor is treated as satisfying its debt for fair market value and then reissuing a new debt, and the creditor is treated as, you know, realizing essentially a loss, but because they're consolidated group members, they generally offset. So there's generally no repercussions. And there's a couple of transactions there where the other thing I'll mention is like 108 between consolidated group members doesn't apply. So if the debtor has debt discharge income, it's taxable income. And the creditor, if it has the corresponding reduction, its loss is generally ordinary loss because of these matching rules. So they basically are put into the same position and they're generally okay. But there are a certain couple of transactions where you have non-intercompany debt. So non-intercompany debt that becomes related party debt. So you have a corporation out there, the consolidated group has lent it money, the debt's trading at a bit of a discount. The parent of the lending group basically buys in the debtor group. So now they're in the same consolidated group. There's a deemed satisfaction reissuance that's deemed to occur. But because it's non-intercompany debt becoming related party debt, 108 could apply to the debtor sub because it wasn't related party. So it could exclude the debt discharge income from taxable income if it was insolvent or in bankruptcy. And the parent unfortunately doesn't otherwise qualify. Its deduction is basically a capital loss. So they're not matching. And the sub can qualify for debt discharge income. But then when they become related, there's the debt's still outstanding. There's a satisfactory issuance, new obligations issued. Same thing I talked about before regarding OID, except there's not retesting of equity. OID doesn't, HIDO doesn't apply within a consolidated group. So those things are generally okay. But these rules, when you have these intercompany obligations that are either they're staying around when a group leaves or they're coming together when a group gets acquired or when they get extinguished, are very complicated. But you have to be mindful just because of the repercussions about what happens when you're trying to get rid of them.
Sure. Is there anything else that we need to cover when we talk about subsidiaries? And then we'll move into, and then we'll kind of wrap up with, again, another in and out of restructuring kind of comparison.
So the issue you have when you're buying like subsidiaries is if you're buying like a sub out of a consolidated group, this is kind of what we've seen in a number of situations. Let's say that consolidated group has an NOL carry forward, but it doesn't otherwise have debt discharge income. It just has carry forward attributes. And what the parent is going to do, the parent's going to sell the sub. But some people aren't being as careful about is who originated those losses. Because if the sub originated those losses, there's a circular stock basis rule, it's 1502-11B, that will prevent the consolidated group from using the sub's NOL carryforwards to offset the gain that the parent has on the disposition of that sub. And it would be sort of an unwelcome surprise when they figured all along, hey, we'll be able to use these losses to offset the gain, and then find out, well, wait a second, I can't use them because this rule tells me that I can't, and then I have to pay more tax on it.
Like I said, let's go into, I guess, the last question here, which is for this section of discussion that we've been having, can you give us a summary of kind of like the really big one or two differences between when you're dealing with a company that is restructuring in versus out of a bankruptcy proceeding?
So I'd say the two big things are, number one, when you're in court, there's careful consideration to obviously the extent of debt to discharge income, but also the type of debt. So if you have non-recourse debt, in certain situations can actually result in taxable gain, which obviously wouldn't be excludable because it generates gain or loss. Whereas recourse debt, to the extent that's reduced, that's compromised, that generates COD income, and that can be excluded, obviously, at the expense of your attributes. So you have to be mindful of the type of debt that you have. Also, you have to be mindful of not having an ownership change sort of at the outset of the bankruptcy, because there's generally a lot of trading in the stock that happens, just speculative trading because the company's sort of liquidity is going down. Where it's going, you don't know. But if it has an ownership change, that will impact the ability to use these very valuable tax attributes on a go-forward basis. Now, when a company is out of bankruptcy, there is careful consideration to what we talked about before, significant modifications. Is the debt being publicly traded? What's the level of debt discharge income it's going to recognize? Where do I sit with respect to insolvency? Do I have the protection of a 1017 liability floor? So there's two big trade-offs. One, not necessarily worried about as much of the debt discharge income. The other side, you are very worried about the type of debt discharge income and the level of your insolvency. Because to the extent that you have debt discharge income, that your debt discharge that's greater than the level of your insolvency actually could turn a certain piece of it into taxable income.
Scott, it's been a real pleasure talking today, especially about such a complex and interesting topic, but I appreciate you taking the time to share your thoughts and your expertise with us.
Thanks, Andy. You're welcome. Listen, I know it's a complicated topic. It's kind of hard to, you know, get it all out in a handful of minutes for people to understand, but just working with troubled companies, it can be very rewarding, and investors in troubled companies can actually have a very good return as long as you're very mindful of the issues you face and you carefully consider them.
Absolutely. And a thanks, as always, to our listeners for checking out this episode of Legal Lens. We'll see you in the next one.